Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Friday, February 14th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Greer.
And I'm Kendra Nordine Beato.
What makes a good president? Two words: emotional intelligence. That was the opinion of renowned presidential scholar Fred Greenstein, in any case. I reread his famous thoughts on the personal qualities that determine presidential performance this week when researching an upcoming President's Day piece. Dr. Greenstein taught politics at Princeton for 30 years. His research helped rejuvenate President Dwight Eisenhower's reputation, among other things. Another of his life's works was intriguing: poring over White House memos and other documents to evaluate presidents on their effectiveness as leaders. His conclusion was a short list of talents he believed the most effective U.S. chief executives shared. The best presidents were effective public communicators, he decided. They had superior organizational capacity and political skills. They had vision. Their cognitive styles reflected strategic thinking, though different presidents were smart in different ways. But emotional intelligence was the most important item on his attribute list, wrote Dr. Greenstein. By that he meant the president's ability to manage his emotions and turn them to constructive purposes, rather than being dominated by them. Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton were among the presidents whose lack of emotional intelligence handicapped them, according to Dr. Greenstein. As to the current occupant of the Oval Office, Dr. Greenstein died in 2018 and thus saw only the beginning of President Donald Trump's term. But according to a colleague, he did say that to a scholar of leadership, the Trump presidency was fascinating. Why? Because it's so different from anything else, he reportedly said. Now to our five stories, which include a tale of justice deferred, lessons for the pursuit of peace, and another way to say, I love you. Our first story: Christopher Scott and Stephen Phillips, two men who were wrongly imprisoned, don't spend their days railing against the justice system. They are helping others who may have been falsely convicted.
There's a lot of waiting and a lot of failure in this line of work. It starts with emptying a North Texas P.O. box full of mail from prisons across the country. And for the letter writers who persuade Christopher Scott and Stephen Phillips to take their cases, the hope is that it ends with a wrongfully convicted person walking free. The reason they do this work is simple. Mr. Scott and Mr. Phillips spent a combined 37 years in prison for crimes for which they were eventually exonerated. That's why they read every letter they receive. It is the tantalizing prospect of uncovering new information that might free other innocent men that drives them. They visit clients in prison and track down potential eyewitnesses. They meet with prosecutors and lawyers. Their Dallas-based nonprofit, House of Renewed Hope, also campaigns for criminal justice reforms and raises awareness about how the system often fails. Criminal convictions are purposefully difficult to overturn, and especially difficult when there's no DNA evidence. The procedural barriers just to reopen a case are almost endless. So what is it that we do, says Mr. Phillips? We deal in the commodity of hope. Don't quit. Don't stop. Keep the hope alive. The story was reported by Henry Gass in Couple, Texas, for The Monitor.
South Africa in the 1980s may offer lessons for Israel today, including the limits of power and economic leverage. The key to ending apartheid ultimately came from a shift in thought inside the establishment.
Israel may not be the apartheid state that its most vocal critics claim, but there are illuminating parallels between South Africa in the 1980s, before Nelson Mandela became president, and Israel's conflict with the Palestinians today. Black South Africans then and Palestinians now faced a huge power deficit. Neither could really threaten the governments they challenged. The economic disparities were also enormous. The white South African government at the time offered huge amounts of cash as inducements. President Donald Trump's new Middle East peace plan makes a similar offer. But power and patronage have their limits. In South Africa, in the end, F.W. de Klerk's government changed course, abandoned apartheid, and paved the way for Mr. Mandela and a black majority rule. In Israel and the West Bank lands that its army and settlers have occupied since 1967, there are no signs of a change of course. Mr. Trump's so-called deal of the century has met with blunt, out-of-hand rejection by the Palestinians, its $50 billion sweetener notwithstanding. Mr. de Klerk's move resolved one decades-long conflict. Mr. Trump's plan may prolong another. The story was reported by Ned Temko in London for The Monitor.
A seismic shift underway in Virginia has lawmakers asking a question once unthinkable for the home of the NRA. How do you ban America's gun?
How would you react to a plainclothes resident strolling down the street with an AR-15 tossed over his shoulder? If you are like Laura Kinzinger of Cape Charles, Virginia, you might call the police and then duck, run, and hide. It might be legal, she says, but it's not normal. But if you are like the 22,000 people who gathered in Richmond, Virginia late last month, openly carrying an assault-style rifle is a form of protest and a reminder of Second Amendment rights. The pictures that are taken from here can live forever and encourage people to remember our rights, says Jeff Hulbert, a gun rights advocate from Maryland who attended the rally. Virginia, a historically gun-friendly southern state, has become a front line in the battle over gun rights in the United States as newly elected Democrats move forward with a ban on new sales of assault-style rifles. It is an amazing moment, says Adam Winkler, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. A lot of people, since the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre, have expressed disappointment that nothing has changed. But we have actually seen a real shift in American gun politics. Virginia is really the crucible of that. The story was reported by Noah Robertson in Richmond, Virginia, and Patrick Johnson in Savannah, Georgia, for The Monitor.
Agriculture is the most foundational of occupations. It is also among the most volatile. We visit an Ohio farm and find that, despite truce in a trade war, one China-related uncertainty has been swapped for another.
A common narrative is that last year was a tough one for U.S. farmers due to the effects of a trade war with China, and now markets are normalizing again. But that's not how soybean and cattle farmer Andy Stickle in Ohio sees it. Uncertainty is high due to the coronavirus outbreak, a separate swine flu that's reducing demand for soybeans to feed Chinese pigs, and questions about the size of the rebound in farm sales due to the recent U.S.-China trade deal. Also, special subsidies meant to shield farmers from the effects of Chinese tariffs are phasing out. This aid from the Trump administration actually overcompensated farmers, according to six separate studies. Yet, farm subsidies reflect a long-standing conservative paradox. While Republicans dislike government aid, they have defended for decades agricultural handouts, which primarily go to rural areas where the party is strongest. And farmers say government assistance has substantive merit. We don't want to continually rely on government support, says Mr. Sickle. The constant thoughts were trade, not aid. But we cannot control Mother Nature, and we've seen more variability over the last few years. Protecting our food supply is important. This story was reported by Lauren Belsey in Bowling Green, Ohio, for The Monitor.
Valentine's Day often arrives with expectations, a bouquet of flowers, a nice dinner out. But to truly tell your sweetheart how you feel, look to love poems. Our poetry reviewer, Elizabeth Lund, shares a bounty of romantic verse to read aloud with your special someone. You can find her poetry recommendations in today's issue. Now, commentary on sports betting from the Monitor's editorial board. The world of sports needs a new type of trophy, one besides the usual awards for game victories, individual talent, or teamwork. It would honor anyone protecting the integrity of sports from the rush to legalize online gambling. One recipient might be Caroline Garcia. On an Instagram post this week, the French professional tennis player released several social media messages from fans. They were expressing outrage against her for losing in a recent tournament. Most of the insults are in principle, yet one is clear. You made me lose my money. As Ms. Garcia explained, gambler's messages. It's standard after a defeat. Today, I just wanted to share them. It doesn't change my life or my goals. Athletics should remain an honest competition of talent and teamwork, free of the taint of those who believe luck is a real force in life, especially as a bringer of quick riches. Sports are in need of champions who will stand athwart the rush for online sports gambling and yell, "Foul!" That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for joining us today. Keep an eye out Monday for a special edition centered on the U.S. holiday of President's Day. We'll be back Tuesday with the first installment of Navigating Uncertainty, a global series on the ways people are dealing with the sense that climate change, populist politics, and other trends have unmoored our world. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective column shares the story of a woman whose prayers were empowered by the idea that the true essence or substance of God's creatures can never be lost. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jessica Mendoza and Jeff Turton.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor, copyright 2020.